things we're dealing with are threats to humanity unlike anything the world has ever seen before.
We can bequeath our children a greener planet and a more prosperous future.
That's what climate change is about. It is literally, not figuratively, a clear and present danger.
If unprecedented changes are not made and made soon, there will be irreversible damage to the planet.
Zero Carbon
Eastall.
Hello and welcome to Zero Carbonista Series 5, Just Stop the Tories. This is the UK's number one podcast that you have to download. If it's green, it's in. And here's the thing, Dale. What's interesting, a little bit of behind-the-scenes stuff. We normally have a bit of an agenda of stuff we might talk about. And then by the time we get to record it, it's all changed. And yes. Your stream of consciousness is pinging like billio over there. And then, you know, other things creep in and we get great questions from listeners as well. But we would be failing to not start with what can only be described as a fake net zero project.
Yeah, that's certainly what we're calling it. It's a kind of gas-fired power station that went into planning with the big claim that it was a net zero carbon emission project with a 5.9 million ton carbon emission cost. I mean, there's nothing zero about that.
Wow, that's quite a lot of tonnage.
But those calculations were actually wrong, and the real figure was four times as high. An environment campaigner wrote to Claire Coutinho, the energy secretary, and pointed out she accepted that the correct figure was 20 million tons of emissions for this not net zero project and gave it the go-ahead anyway. We are challenging that. We're going to judicial review to try and stop that project. And we think we can hold it up long enough that there's an election before that planning permission gets confirmed. Because once it's been confirmed, it's going to be much harder for Labour to come in and undo it. But 20 million tons. And by the way, that 20 million tons is only based anyway on the belief, you've got to call it a belief, that they can take 95% of the carbon away by this mythical process called carbon capture and storage. I mean, that's a big imagination those guys have got there, and still they end up with 20 million f***ing tons.
I mean, this would be, well, it wouldn't be okay, but it would kind of be okay by their reckoning if they didn't allude to the net zero bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, at least.
You could go, well, at least, you know, you're being honest about your desire to decimate the planet. I mean, that's fine. Right. So we don't agree with you, but we doff our cap to your brutal honesty.
This is fake on fake, right? It's fake to call it net zero. They should call it the 20 million ton project. And anyway, the 20 million tons is based on the fake idea that carbon capture and storage exists anywhere in the world. It works economically and technically, and it's the answer to... I mean, this is why it's being pushed on us by the big oil companies, that basically they're saying, don't worry, we can keep burning fossil fuels because we've got this thing coming along called carbon capture and storage. Well, it ain't here. It's been talked about for years. It ain't going to get here. It's not going to work economically. And so, yeah, this is fake on fake.
It's fake on. This has gone to Fakesville and gone up the town hall steps and got the fake medal. It's been made the mayor. A Fakesville.
I was thinking, we need a fake off competition. That's what we need.
Yeah, the Great British Fake Off. Yes. I mean, we're on it. This one's going to take some beating.
It is.
Because what's interesting is that those ministers would go on TV with a straight face and talk about the net zero components of this idea, even though there are demonstrably none.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because Rishi Sunak is the guy, after all, that tells us that drilling in the North Sea is how we get our energy bills down and how we get energy secure, which is complete and utter nonsense. His energy minister resigned today, by the way. We don't know why, whether he can just see electoral oblivion coming or he's had a pang of conscience over the fossil foolishness of Sunak's position. We just don't know.
Are you the first person to say fossil foolishness?
I think I might be. I've been adopting it as my...
Oh, we need to keep that one going.
It's my favourite way to describe what Sunak is up to.
And also, it all fits nicely into this. And let's reintroduce a character that we spoke of only last week on the podcast, Dale, and that was Michael Fabricant.
Yeah. I mean, him and Richard Tice and some other dude who's also a Tory MP, they all had a pop at me over some fake news from Guido Fawkes, this dude that bases himself in a legally immune jurisdiction and then, you know, spouts lies, basically. So he said something about Hamas and me, and Fabricant repeated it, Tice repeated it, some other dude, can't even remember his name. We wrote them all legal letters, and Mikey Fabricant, the very next day, he was on Twitter saying, I've apologized, I was wrong, blah, blah, blah. The funny thing about that was he never actually apologized. He just told everybody he did. And that was amusing.
Have you got anything since then?
No. No, he still hasn't apologized. He's told everybody. And you think, well, maybe he thinks that's good enough. If you say I've apologized, then maybe that's the same as actually apologizing. But yeah. I'm not sure most of us would think that. Ticey, on the other hand, I think he's going to fight it, which is a bit of fun. But he sent back his kind of counter suit because I've been calling Reform a far-right party like the BBC used to until he complained to them. And I've been calling him a far-right leader. I figure if you lead a far-right party, you must be a far-right leader. That sounds like a fair comment to me. So now he's claiming libel for that, which I think is hilarious. And I can't imagine he wants to go to court and argue that Reform's not a far-right party and he's not the leader. But maybe he does. I don't know. That's where we are, really, in the world of right-wing nuts. Like, suits and counter-suits are flying left, right, and center.
Brilliant. I've got popcorn while I'm telling you this, by the way, Dale.
Yeah.
This is good.
It's worthy of popcorn.
Let's do a question here. This comes in from Charlie. He says, do you think we can regain our status as a world leader by being energy independent?
Well, I think it's a long time ago that we had any world leadership status. I think last 14 years, the Tories have been saying it kind of every other week. We lead the world in this, we lead the world in that. But what do we really lead the world in? Bullshit. I'm just going to say bullshit.
Bullshit. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because that shows you where we're at, the fact that we're like struggling to find something we lead the world in. And right. After two grown men, fairly intelligent characters, struggled, we settled on the word bullshit.
We did. We did. And to answer the question, if we get to energy independence, yes, we will actually lead the world in something. And it would be something to behold anyway for a country. I mean, it's kind of almost happened in Paraguay, I think it is, or Uruguay. They were about 95% or something like that from green energy, which is amazing. It's a much smaller country, of course, than ours. So it'd be a big deal. I'm just going to say, yeah.
Yeah. Bullshit and river shit, because that brings us to Thames water.
Yeah. I was hoping that would be the link for this beautiful story. Thames water on the verge of bankruptcy. The whole water industry is on the verge of bankruptcy, actually. We know that privatization is a desperate failure, wherever it's been, in water, in energy, in trains, in buses, that kind of stuff. But maybe there's no better, bigger example than in water companies. The news today is that this almost bankrupt industry paid out $2.5 billion in dividends in the last 2 years, increased their debt by $8.2 billion at the same time, and have paid out $78 billion in dividends since privatization. I mean, that's about $2.5 billion every year since privatization, while not investing in the infrastructure needed. So, you know, our rivers and seas are full of shit because of that. And the private owners simply won't put any money in. All they want to do is take money out. And the whole model is, well, quite frankly, f***ed. It doesn't work. It's not fit for purpose. And we can't see a better example of privatization not being fit for purpose, I think, right now than in the water industry. You know, it's owned by foreign offshore pension funds what are they called? Sovereign. Yeah. I mean, so we'll leave your nan out of this. So it's... I mean, it's owned by foreign investors, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, you know, often from oil states and stuff like that, private equity, all those kinds of people, you know, and all they got into it for was to suck money out of our economy and out of our water system. And you know, the result is, well, shit everywhere, quite frankly. And the whole thing may go bankrupt. And if it does, I think that would be the easiest, cheapest way for an incoming Labour government to pick it up and actually nationalise it.
And it's interesting because it's one of those rare areas that does sort of unite quite a lot of Tories and quite a lot of, you know, speak to the average Tory and say, what do you think about water privatisation? And most of them will go, it's a shit idea.
Yes.
It's a stupid idea.
I think you're right, actually. I think I saw a poll that suggested most Tory voters think it should be taken back into public ownership.
Everybody says this, but it is literally like trying to privatise air. Yeah. I mean, it's nonsensical.
Just wrong. And my view is that what we've privatized since Thatcher, I mean, she's the ultimate right wing nut, really. What we've privatized, all the essential infrastructure for our country, for any country, right? Water, energy, transport, essential public interest infrastructure. And we've given it to private interests who only want to make money, don't want to invest, and not interested in the long term. And, you know, 20, 30 years later, look what's happened. All of these industries are on their knees and our country along with them.
Let's have a look. What you call the bread and butter, I suppose, of the kind of environment current green debate, and that's about temperatures, and March temperatures, which clearly provided some food for thought, I think.
Yeah, so it's just been revealed that March was the hottest March that we've ever had, and it was the 10th straight month in a row to set a temperature record, which is pretty incredible. And at the same time, I was reading today that the permafrost in the Arctic region is now a net contributor of CO2. It used to absorb CO2, but the global temperature is thawing the permafrost, releasing CO2, which is driving the global temperature up. And we've got this kind of positive feedback loop that nobody needs at all, but we can see it happening now. Off the back of that, also, we learned that last year was a record for insurance claims due to, let's use inverted commas here and call it weather, over £500 billion worth of damage caused by the weather, which is up 36% on the year before. This is our future until somebody gets a grip of this and we get our carbon emissions down to zero. Is anybody in number 10 listening? I don't think so.
Here's a question from Alex, who says, when will I be able to fly to Europe with EcoJet? Well, explain EcoJet firstly, Dale, for those who don't know.
Yeah, EcoJet is a new thing that we started last summer. It's a zero carbon airline. We're going to fly with hydrogen technology, hydrogen being used through a fuel cell to make electricity to drive electric motors, just to explain that. Our first two planes will be in the air this summer with a range of about 300 miles. And within 12 months, we'll have a 500-mile range. But our first two planes, I should say, will run on kerosene. The hydrogen technology is going through accreditation, let's call it, with the Civil Aviation Authority to be approved, you know, for passenger use and stuff. And I think it'll be with us about 12 months from now. So 12 months from now, to get to the answer, you'll be able to fly across Britain, zero emissions. And I reckon another 12 months and we'd be flying people to Europe.
Amazing. What the hell does an aeroplane cost?
I don't know. We lease them, so that's all right. We ain't got to buy them.
There's no big cable attached that follows the plane around.
That's right.
It's not plugged in anywhere.
Nothing like that. And the beauty, for me, the real beauty of this kind of model that we're pursuing is we're not building new airplanes. We're taking existing planes and we're retrofitting electric engines and a fuel cell and a hydrogen tank, which is, you know, it's repurposing. Reusing.
Yeah. Let's move to this story. It's an M&S story that I suppose has, as in Marks and Spencers, which I guess is quite amusing.
I'm amused by it. They're trying to tackle methane from burping and farting cows. I mean, that's funny to start with, right? Cows are like one of the biggest contributors of carbon on the planet, about 14% or something like that globally. You know, basically methane leaks out of both ends of a cow. And it's one of the biggest reasons why we have to eat less animals and eat more plants. And there are a lot of people actually around going, well, what can we do about this? How can we avoid the reality that we have to eat less animals? Even Zuckerberg's getting involved. You know, he's got some farm where he makes Wagyu beef, you know, that kind of massaged Japanese cow-based stuff, you know, and he's feeding on, I don't know, beer and stuff. And he's, you know, he's like, oh, we can make this more climate friendly. You can't, right? And M&S can't either. They're spending £1 million on this plan to feed cows something different that makes them burp and fart less, right? I mean, I don't know what it is. It doesn't say in this story, but they expect to save about 11,000 tons of greenhouse gas. So that's £100 per ton of greenhouse gas. And this stuff at the moment is being sold on the market for £5 a ton. It's a hopeless, futile way to try and solve the problem. And the obvious thing to do is just have less cows.
Well, I was going to say, if this was a sitcom, a bloke with a microphone would turn up at the, you know, M&S head honcho's house and just go, I don't want to be controversial here, but have you ever thought about not actually eating the cow?
That's right.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Never thought of that. You're coming up with, like Roadrunner style, coming up with ever more imaginative ways to, we'll just give it a better diet. We'll just put it in a different kind of field. We'll just feed it on something different. What about you don't eat the cow?
Just don't have it, yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea. Never thought of that.
And in this case, it's about milk-producing cows. I mean, they do eventually go to be eaten after like 7 years of hell in a dairy farm. But, you know, we don't need to drink cow's milk. It's not made for us. It's made for baby cows. It's not good for us. I mean, oat milk. Everybody loves oat milk. Anybody that, you know, uses it to give up cow's milk, I mean, they just love it. it uses far less resources in terms of water and everything else, produces far less carbon and no methane.
Indeed. Here's a question from Bert. Are Labour going to neglect nature and wildlife? They are the urban party.
Well, I don't think they will. I don't know if there's a clue out there that I'm missing that Labour are, you know, blind to the countryside and to nature and that kind of stuff. I honestly don't know. Short answer, I don't think so.
And there is a bit of a food theme on this today, Del, because new Brexit checks are going to cause absolute, well, as my old nan would have said, f***ing chaos over there at the border checks, because importers are pulling their hair out about what might be happening.
Yeah, and actually they're pulling out of the market as well. This is what we're being told by the industry, that people in Europe are refusing to send their stuff to Britain because they're now having to pay £145 in extra fees for every consignment. So it's importers and export, are both just exporters just throwing their hands up and saying, you know, WTF, actually. And this industry says that this is going to cause food shortages. The problem is that big. I mean, it's just another example of what Brexit didn't give us, isn't it? All of the things they said it was going to give us didn't happen, and now we've got this guy. We've got famine in Britain coming. No, I'm exaggerating. But honestly, what can you say? It's so exasperating. We were supposed to save red tape, weren't we? And we were supposed to get cheaper things and less red tape. And what we've got is the opposite. More expensive things, so expensive that people won't even send them here. You know, less choice, more red tape. I mean, what the f***?
Yeah. How did it work out, that thing? I mean, it was, I don't know how we'll look at this in 20 years' time. I mean, I know how we're looking at it now. In 20 years' time, maybe we'll be back in some kind of agreement. But
it's funny. I'm thinking of Liz Truss now. You know, give her, what, 3-4 months after her disastrous month in charge, and she's looking back at it going, well, it wasn't me. Nobody understood me. The markets were some kind of lefty kind of you know, collusion to bring down the government. And I mean, she lives in a fantasy world. The Brexit champions lived in a fantasy world. Actually, I don't think they care that they talk nonsense. I think they knew they did. It was just self-interest.
And the funny thing, I bumped into her today, by the way, Liz Truss. Literally, I mean, in the corridor, I was going one way and her handlers, she might have only lasted half an hour as a prime minister, but she has a couple of characters around her, obviously, because that goes with the territory. And I was walking down the corridor and she was walking the other way and she sort of slightly smiled at me.
Slightly.
I looked at her very politely, as my mum told me to be, just sort of returned a very sort of tacit smile. Mm. But it was interesting that she was originally a Remainer, who then became almost the flag-waving archdeacon of all things Brexit. Yeah.
And I think your nan and your mum, they're different characters, right? Because your nan would have told her to f*** off.
She would have done, yeah. Whereas my mum would have gone, oh, you can't say that.
Be nice to her.
I don't know why my mum's got a northern accent, but that's another story. Nice, nice, polite young man. And this from David, final question, says, should the UK sign up to the plant-based treaty?
Yes.
For those not initiated with it, tell us about the plant-based treaty, Dale.
Well, I think it's, I'm going to sound like I'm being stupid now, but it's a treaty about plant-based eating that you can sign up to as a country or a university or a company or a person. And actually, you know, it's just about plants instead of animals. Yeah. I mean, that's how it boils down to me. It's dead simple. So the answer, of course, is yes. Yes, they should. Everybody should sign up to the plant-based treaty, but preferably don't just sign it, do something about it.
Actions louder than words, yeah, as the phrase goes. We'll speak in a few days, Dale.
Brilliant. I'm looking forward to it.
Don't forget, of course, to follow this podcast so that you get each episode automatically. Follow Dale on social media, twitter.com/DaleVince, facebook.com/DaleVince, and on TikTok too.
Zero Carbon East Off.